This conference will now be recorded.
So let's go ahead and call the July 7th meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order. And as always, we'll begin with a flag salute. Vincent, could you lead the flag salute, please?
Sure thing, Mayor.
Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call.
Mayor Pruitt.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Hoogstraat.
Here.
Councilmember Bond.
Here.
Councilmember Todd.
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Here.
Councilmember Steckler. Councilmember Pena.
Here.
Okay, and we'll just wait for John to, he'll either join us on phone or on the computer. So first up is audience communication. Does anybody want to talk to the council tonight?
I'd like to speak.
Okay, name, address, and 3 minutes, please.
My name is Miguel Morga. My address is 1108 Chenault Beach Road, apartment 2424. In Mukilteo, Washington, 98275. Am I okay to proceed?
Yeah, go ahead, Miguel.
So I wanted to address the council. I'm the union representative for the AFSCME bargaining unit that's employed in the city of Mill Creek. And I have the distinction of being the director of staff services for AFSCME Council 2, working with employers and locals throughout the state of Washington with the 17,000 members that we represent. Over the past month, there has been discussion related to reduction of employees in the AFSCME represented bargaining unit. And I want to make sure that I express that virtually every municipality that we have contracts in have been looking to address any budget shortfalls through layoff alternatives such as furlough agreements or voluntary separation agreements prior to the imposition of any layoffs. In the city of Mill Creek, the union responded to notices of layoffs that were provided to us on June 10th with some various options that the city finance department has indicated provide the same level of savings as the layoffs that were set to be imposed. But those, that proposal, that concept has been rejected. And I want to express that the decision to pursue layoffs or alternatives to layoffs is a policy decision that the city council should be a part of and directing. And so we've heard a lot of comments either through direct communications or reading in the media or listening at prior council meetings that there appears to be a desire of many council members to pursue alternatives to layoffs to address budget shortfalls. And so the union would ask if that truly is the policy directive of the council, that be communicated, because I believe we have the ability to do so, but there has to be that desire. And so we hope if that is the directive of the council, that be expressed, given that this is the final meeting before these layoffs are set to go into effect. And with that, I have nothing further to say.
Okay, thank you very much, Miguel. Does anybody else want to talk to the council tonight?
I do.
Okay,
do.
Name, address, and 3 minutes, please.
Sure. My name is Daniel Carr, 7C Swim School. I'm actually the study session number C. And so I just want to be available to communicate during that study sessions if you guys have any questions.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. Anybody else?
Going yes, I'd once? Like to speak, please.
Okay, name, address.
Name, John Raymer. Address, 831 148th Street, Southeast in Mill Creek. My son attends Henry Jackson High School, or at least we're hoping he'll go back to Henry Jackson this September. As such, we live very close to it, and occasionally my son walks to school. About a year ago, County Councilman Terry Ryan brought a large check, a grant of $100,000, and gave it to the city of Mill Creek. That was to upgrade the crossing alarms and such for several of our schools, including the one my son goes to. To date, none of the projects that money was earmarked for have been executed, and I'd like to know what the status is of those projects and why they haven't been executed, because I believe there was a deadline on how long you could keep that money before you lose the grant. So I'd like to hear what happened and what is going on with the project to upgrade those crossing guard marks and what happened to the $100,000. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to talk to the council tonight? Going once, twice? Okay, with that, we'll move on to our regular agenda. And we have a study session. And first up is Police Department Use of Force Policies, Training, and Response to the Community. City Manager?
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw and members of council. We've all been following the headlines recently in the wake of the recent deaths of many African-American men and women at the hands of law enforcement, which has appeared to cause anger, frustration, in some cases, fear of law enforcement. The city of Mill Creek's police department is one that I have had the occasion to observe firsthand, particularly around how they manage the recent protests in our city. It is one of my core experiences and strengths is working with law enforcement through my entire career. What I do want to share with council is that I am eminently impressed by the restraint and the belief in the values, the core values that our police department has with regard to their role of limited powers as a police agency in a free society. But we don't in our department on the core values of empathy, courage, and resourcefulness. Not only are we committed to continue evaluating our policies and expectations, but we are working to ensure that they're carried out in a way that fulfills a police officer's oath and is consistent with the values of the police department in the city of Mill Creek. What we have this evening is a presentation from Chief Eastman, who has worked very hard to develop frequently asked questions and information. It is by no means the final iteration of this for us, but as information develops, as you as members of council provide feedback to us, and as the community provides feedback, we intend to be responsive and transparent and are open and are flexible to where and how we might modify. So we believe that the starting point this evening is for Chief Eastman to present as it relates to our department's policies regarding use of force, training, and responsiveness to our community. Chief Eastman.
Thank you, Michael. Mayor, Council, I really appreciate this opportunity to share with you this evening. Just want to verify that you can see my PowerPoint screen. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Mayor, before Chief goes on, I think I can see in the attendees that Councilmember Steckler has joined us, although his video doesn't show. I want to make sure he gets recorded as being part of the meeting if that's the case. Can we check in with him?
Sure. John, are you there? John?
Okay, maybe not. I just see him as one of the attendees. I wanted to make sure his attendance was recorded when it happened. My apologies, Chief. Go ahead.
No problem. So as the city manager said, with the recent events around the nation and as close as Tacoma, It has resulted in understandable concern about police policies and use of force. And I wanted to take an opportunity to share with council and our community what our current policies and our procedures and our training is, and really share a little bit as the leader of the organization where my heart is and where we go from here to make sure that we're responsive and accountable to the public. Trying to advance here. So this is a section from a letter that I posted on had posted on the website that I just want to read. It said, our core values of empathy, courage, and resourcefulness do not allow discrimination of any kind. It is not enough to rest on our values and condemn the wrongdoing of other law enforcement officers. We must be committed to continually evaluate our policies and expectations and ensure that these are carried out in a way that fulfills our oath and is consistent with our values. I am committed to providing a safe and welcoming community for anyone and everyone who lives, works, or visits the city of Mill Creek. And I echo what the city manager said, that we are not resting on our laurels, and I hope that is clear, that we, as we've even gone through this process, we have accepted the challenge from outside groups that are looking for certain changes in police policy. And so my hope tonight is to show you where we are consistent with those requests, and then where we're not, explain the rationale behind it. This is a section in our use of force policy that I think summarizes our overall use of force policy. It says that it is the policy of the Mill Creek Police Department to value and preserve human life. The use of force by law enforcement personnel is a matter of critical concern, both to the public and to the law enforcement community. Officers are involved on a daily basis in numerous and varied interactions and, when warranted, may use reasonable force in carrying out their duties. Officers must have an understanding of and true appreciation for their authority and limitations. This is especially true with respect to overcoming resistance while engaged in the performance of law enforcement duties. The department recognizes and respects the value of all human life and dignity without prejudice to anyone. Vesting officers with the authority to use reasonable force and to protect the public welfare requires monitoring, evaluation, and a careful balancing of all interests. So as we look at our policy, you'll see an overarching theme of reasonableness and necessary use of force. So first, looking at state law says that whenever use force is lawful whenever necessarily used by a public officer in the performance of a legal duty or a person assisting the officer in acting under the officer's direction. The state law defines necessary as meaning that no reasonably effective alternative to the use of force appeared to exist and that the amount of force used was reasonable to affect the lawful purpose intended. So that's the state requirement. And as we look at federal law, you're going to see a term throughout our use of force policy which says objectively reasonable. And this came from a 1989 U.S. Supreme Court, Graham v. Connor, which in the 31 years since it went into effect is still the law of the land. There's been some clarifications, if you will. But I want to share some information about this because as we as public officials and as the public look at whether a use of force incident was lawful, Graham v. Connor really sets the bar and gives us the criteria in order to appropriately do that. So Graham v. Connor said that as in other Fourth Amendment contexts, the reasonableness inquiry in an excessive force case is an objective one. So Graham v. Connor changed from an Eighth Amendment cruel, unusual punishment subjective standard to an objectively reasonable standard. So what that did basically is took out the officer's intentions and looked at what would a reasonable officer with the same facts, same training, same circumstances, what would a reasonable officer do? And that, that becomes the determination as to whether the force is lawful.
Chief?
Yes.
When we have these changes or dialogues, shouldn't we be incorporating what's within the confines of the use of force, the accepted use of force continuum as well?
I'll talk about use of force continuum.
Sir, didn't mean to jump again.
No, I appreciate that. So this is kind of what I summarized, that the reasonableness of particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene. The Supreme Court recognizes and has long time recognizes the officer's right to make an arrest or investigatory stop, necessarily carries with it the right to use some degree of physical coercion or threat thereof to effect it. But again, it must be judged from the perspective of the reasonable officer at the scene rather than the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. So I'm going to go through some of the questions that you have probably received. I think a lot of those came from the Eight Can't Wait campaign. I would welcome anyone to look at their website. I've done so. I think that that they've done a good job of explaining what their intent is. We may differ on some things, but I don't question their purpose and their intent. So, does our use of force policy require de-escalation? It does. Does the officer should use de-escalation techniques and other alternatives as opposed to higher levels of force, consistent with their training whenever possible and appropriate, before resorting to force and to reduce the need for force. And then there's a definition of what de-escalation is. With de-escalation, it's important to understand that de-escalation doesn't always happen. If there is an imminent threat to life, de-escalation may not be appropriate because of necessary time in order to implement any de-escalation techniques. But as you'll see from the definition, even in a deadly force situation, sometimes even just using barriers or what we call tactical repositioning may be in itself a de-escalation technique. So does your use of force Chief? Policy have a use of force continuum
Chief
that defines
may interrupt for a second? Chief?
Of course.
I apologize, but in the process of getting Councilmember Steckler connected, it looks like we lost your screen.
Oh, okay.
You could re-initiate your screen. We could see your slides.
Yeah, I just sent you a request, Chief.
Yeah, I thought it was an error and I canceled it.
So okay. I'll send you. There you go.
No, I just... Okay, great.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
No problem. So the specific term use of force continuum refers to an outdated concept that's no longer taught at the State Criminal Justice Training Commission. What is basically taught now is that whatever the force is has to be objectively reasonable based on the totality of the circumstances. As opposed to the use of force continuum, which kind of implied that you needed to start at the lowest end of the continuum, which was officer presence, then went to verbal persuasion, and then escorting and on up to deadly force. If you have a situation where somebody is shooting at you, obviously verbal persuasion and some of the lower forms of force are not going to be objectively reasonable based on those circumstances. So the officers can use any of their use of force options as long as they are objectively reasonable and regardless of where they may fall on an old use of force continuum. And this is consistent with federal case law, Washington state law, and current law enforcement best practices. So does your use of force policy allow for chokeholds or strangleholds, including carotid restraints? The simple answer is no, but I think this requires some clarification. So what we have seen with Eric Garner and even with George Floyd were chokeholds that did interfere, they restricted airflow. There is a what I believe to be a legitimate technique, used to be called lateral vascular neck restraints, sometimes called carotid neck control. It does not block the airway. It restricts blood flow to the brain temporarily and basically causes a person to pass out. I will tell you that I think that this is an effective technique in a lot of situations that actually prevents higher levels of force and is actually one of the few things that work when somebody is experiencing what's called excited delirium. But it requires a lot of training. First of all, we do not use that technique. It was something we were looking at going to, but as I've talked to my use of force instructors, we have all agreed that this is not the time to even consider that. There's just too much attached to that idea. So so the bottom line is no, we do not provide those we do not train for the use of any sort of chokehold, stranglehold, or carotid control. Does your policy
Chief?
Yes, please.
So just so everybody and the public may be clear as well, while we are not trained to use them as offensive techniques, they are and should always be, just like with the sheriff's office, state patrol, on and on, that in the instance when you're in a potential level 3 use of force situation, and for those that don't understand that, that is where deadly force or you feel your lives are in danger as an officer or the public, then it is authorized, and the state and federal laws do umbrella that policy.
Yeah, so I agree with that. Let me make a distinction, though, just for the public. When we're talking about this, the use of force that I'm presenting, these are using force towards a lawful purpose. And so what Councilmember Cavalieri is saying is that if you're in a life and death, you're not worried about arresting this person. You're basically just trying to save your life or the life of somebody else. Generally, all bets are off. Anything you could see in professional wrestling, I mean, whatever you need to do to save your life, just like any citizen would be able to do. And so it's important to distinguish that from we are using objectively reasonable force to take this person into custody, as opposed to, as Councilmember Cavalieri's describing a life-saving self-defense situation.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, and our policy does not address that because that's not the intent of the use of force policy. So it is talking about towards a lawful purpose. Does your policy prohibit hog-tying methods in transporting individuals in uncomfortable positions, such as face down in the vehicle? So let me describe what hog-tying is. You can probably get the visual, but you're talking about a person that is on their stomach, handcuffed behind their back, and then their legs, there's something tied around their legs, which is attached to the handcuffs. And that is the classic hog-tying method. We do not use hog ties. We have leg restraints that go around the individual's legs and are attached to the door to restrain their lower body while they are seated upright in the car. So it's inherently dangerous to have somebody on their stomach, especially in the hog tying position, but in general, And so we avoid that as much as possible. And so our policy makes it clear that that once that the individual should be pleaded, placed in a seated and upright position, it should not be placed on their stomach for an extended period, as that could reduce the person's ability to breathe. And probably just important is it makes it a lot more difficult for us to monitor their well-being. And so we also do not, our training prohibits that attaching of leg restraints to handcuffs, which would put somebody in the hog tying position. Does your policy require a verbal warning when possible before using deadly force? Yes and no. So the first section here is talking about the what used to be the old fleeing felon rule. It's based on a case called Tennessee v. Gardner, and that basically says if the officer has probable cause to believe that the person has committed, intends to commit a felony involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious bodily injury or death, and the officer believes that there's an imminent risk of serious bodily injury or death to any other person, if the subject is not immediately apprehended, they can use deadly force. Our policy does require, however, when feasible, that we give the person a warning. So again, this is an important distinction with this, where somebody is running away and is not shooting at the officer or threatening the officer. But if we allow them to leave, then we have that imminent risk of serious bodily injury or death to another person if we don't stop them. As opposed to a person where deadly force is used to protect the officer or others when it's objectively reasonable to believe that there's an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury, the officer is not required to give a verbal warning in that circumstance. It doesn't mean that they can't, but that type of situation, the risk is such that if to delay the use of force could potentially put the officer or another person who's being threatened at risk if for the officer to fail to take action. So again, it really depends on the situation. Does your policy prohibit shooting at people in moving vehicles unless a person poses a deadly threat by means other than the vehicle, for example, shooting at people from a vehicle? So our policy basically says that shooting at vehicles is generally ineffective and dangerous, and that the officers, rather than shooting at a vehicle, should be making every effort to get out of the path of the vehicle. And if even if they are unable to do that, the officer can only discharge a firearm at a moving vehicle or its occupants when the officer reasonably believes there is no reasonable means available to avert the threat of the vehicle and the deadly force would otherwise be justified. So, and they can't shoot. They can't shoot tires out or shoot at the engine or something like that in an attempt to disable the vehicle. Does your policy require officers to exhaust all other reasonable alternatives before resorting to using deadly force? So again, our use of force policy is based on the principle that force applied by an officer must be necessary and objectively reasonable. When determining whether to apply force and evaluating whether an officer has used reasonable force, we ask our officers to look at a number of factors as time and circumstances permit. I did not include that list and it's not an inclusive list. It's just basically including but not limited to different factors that the officer should be taking into consideration. That is part of the documents on the website and it's part of the document that was attached to the council agenda. I will say that some of those would make sense to you. It could be things like the number of people versus the number of officers, size, strength differences. It could be whether the person is suffering from a mental illness, whether they're under the influence, appear to be under the influence of some sort of controlled substance. The list is would make sense to you when you read it because it would be things that you would assume that an officer would take into consideration. But those that not inclusive list or exclusive list is attached. If anybody wants to look at that. Does your policy require officers to intervene to stop another officer from using excessive force? Yes. Our policy says that any officer present and observing another officer using force that is clearly beyond that which is objectively reasonable under the circumstances shall, when in a position to do so, intercede to prevent the use of unreasonable force. In addition, an officer who observes another employee use force that exceeds the degree of force permitted by law should promptly report those observations to a supervisor. We have had a lot of conversations about George Floyd's death. And I can tell you, too, an officer, we're appalled not only by the officer who was, had his knee on George Floyd's neck, but the three officers that were standing by and not doing anything. And I like to use the tag team wrestling kind of analogy and the idea that, you know, you go up and you tag your buddy and you say, hey, let me take over. I got this guy. And this comes into other areas. We have this kind of practice at the end of a vehicle pursuit where the officer might be kind of amped up and that officer that's been the pursuing officer probably should not be the one putting the handcuffs on the person. And so we'll let that officer kind of step back and cool down, and we'll let cooler heads take the person into custody. So I have an officer disagree that if they were in that position, they would have been intervening forcefully if necessary. As I mentioned in the article with the Mill Creek Beacon, you know, when somebody's handcuffed on their stomach, generally the fight's over, and there's really was no need for what we saw in Minneapolis. Does your policy require officers to report all use of force, including threatening another person with a firearm? So there's a lot here. I'm just going to summarize it. We have multiple levels of reporting. First of all, our officers are required to document all use of force. And that means that even if it didn't result in a police report, for example, maybe somebody was briefly detained while they were doing an investigation, but was released when it realized that no crime had occurred. That's if force was used, there's documentation. It could be in CAD notes. We have less formal reports, incident reports within our computer system. We also have a list of levels of use of force that require the officer to do a case report and fill out a form which captures the data piece of it. And that helps us with our tracking and our analysis. In addition to that, if it's a serious use of force or there's an allegation of a serious use of force, supervisors are required to come to the scene and do a preliminary investigation. On top of that, we have use of force review boards that review any serious use of force that results in very serious injury or death. And if it is a serious injury or death, that investigation is going to be done by the Snohomish Multi-Agency Response Team, or SMART. And if you heard about I-940 and the eventual legislation that came from that, it called for an independent investigation. The good news is Snohomish County has had that for some time, but SMART is completely complying with all the requirements from I-940, including having civilian involvement. So they're required to have civilians part of or informed as to the investigation, so that there's some accountability from the very beginning. And I don't know if it comes up in another question, it may, but I'll just mention it now, that we use that data from those use of force reports as an early warning system. So if we see that a particular officer has more use of force incidents than their counterparts, that may at the very least result in a conversation and some questions as to determine why. It could be a completely legitimate reason, or there may be an issue that we need to handle. Are your officers trained to perform and seek necessary medical action after using force? Yes. So all our officers are trained in first aid and CPR. Our policy says that once the scene is safe and assumed as practical, an officer shall provide appropriate medical care consistent with his or her training to any individual who has visible injuries, complains of being injured, or requests medical attention. So this may include providing first aid, requesting emergency medical services, and or arranging for transportation to an emergency medical facility. Our officers actually carry fairly advanced first aid equipment. They have chest seals, and they have powder that is a quick clotting device, and they carry tourniquets. So this we had two recent incidents that weren't involving officers using force where they were able to use it. One was the 12-year-old that was stabbed at the Heatherwood. Our officers provided first aid before the fire department arrived. And then the domestic violence situation where the suspect who was strangling his girlfriend and was stabbed, we put one of our officers put a chest seal on his stab wound while they waited for the paramedics to arrive. So they're very confident and very willing, and the intent of this question is that there have been situations where it was real or perceived that there was a use of deadly force, and that the officers basically stood around when the person bled to death. And so we use every means available to us as soon as it's safe and practical to do so, regardless of whether they were somebody that was trying to kill one of our officers, or in these last two situations where they were actually victims while they had sustained injuries that did not involve law enforcement.
Let's not forget the naloxone intervention issues as well, where we have brought many folks, not just this department, but across the county, back from overdose.
That's true. So for the public, that is the nasal spray that counteracts the effects of opioid use. So, and it saved many lives. Councilmember Cavalieri is correct. That's probably the thing that gets used more often in the county, I think, than anything, and is pretty amazing to watch. I would, if you ever get a chance.
It is.
Is there any early intervention system to correct officers who use excessive force? How many complaints does an officer have to receive before they are reprimanded, before they are terminated? So, as I mentioned before, we have our use of force documentation and reporting requirements. We have our oversight from supervisor on scene investigation. We have our use of force review board. We have deadly force incidents that are investigated by SMART. And as I mentioned before, the data that we get from the use of force reports are compiled and used to identify any trends that may require early intervention. As far as how many complaints somebody gets, the question just doesn't really quite understand how discipline works for public employees, but as you are aware, officers can only be disciplined for sustained complaints based on the just cause standard. So Their discipline is going to be based on the severity of the offense and must be progressive. That doesn't mean that somebody couldn't get fired for a single incident if it was serious enough, but generally it would require progressive discipline that would lead to more serious discipline. I've read this in a couple of things. The belief that if you get three or more complaints that you should not be a police officer. I can tell you in my 30 years of law enforcement, I've gotten lots of complaints. I've probably had a couple that were ever sustained, and those were rudeness complaints just because I let my mouth fly when it shouldn't have. We don't take action based on the number of complaints. We can only take action on sustained complaints. Are officers thoroughly vetted to ensure they do not have a history of abuse, racism, xenophobia, homophobia, transphobia, or discrimination? So we do a robust background investigation to try and identify any issues that would prohibit somebody from being a police officer. We get a lot of good information from friends, neighborhoods, coworkers. We interview spouses and significant others to try and identify any issues that may be indicative of somebody that shouldn't be in law enforcement. In addition to that, all our officers are required to pass a polygraph examination, a psychological examination, and a medical examination. We cannot require officers to submit to ongoing psychological examinations without a reason, but our policy does allow us to require psychological examinations, generally called fit for duty examinations, if the employee undergoes a significant event. Sometimes that happens after an officer-involved shooting, or it could be other circumstances that would reasonably indicate an officer is unable to safely and properly perform his or her job functions. And that's often, the only times I've ever been a part of implementing that has not been when an officer did something wrong. They were just part of a really traumatic incident that we needed a professional to be able to evaluate their ability to continue to be in law enforcement. And then, but on top of that, I should say that we do some things to ensure our officers' mental health. So we have a peer support program that we are actually have been in the last 4 or 5 months have really been revitalizing, and that is where officers are trained and have legal protection to have conversations with officers that maybe be right after a critical incident. We've had situations where we responded to SID's deaths and there's some, upsetting stuff that happens. And so a peer being able to check in with that person and make sure they're okay and give them some tools to think about so that they can take care of themselves. In addition, we have access to critical incident stress debriefings. We had a 4-month-old that died of apparently of SIDS. That was traumatic for a couple of our officers that went through that, and they participated in a critical incident stress debriefing with a Snohomish 911 dispatcher and some folks in the fire district. So, and then we provide access to mental health therapists for folks that maybe need a little extra help dealing with the stress of an incident, just to keep them healthy. Just some things I would love the opportunity to talk about in the future. Some of these Michael and I have already been discussing. Body-worn cameras is become more and more of an expectation for law enforcement. That's not an easy answer. And so I would love to come back at some point and provide an update on where the Public Records Act is in reference to body-worn cameras, what challenges there are, and really what it would take if it's the will of the community and the council to implement a body-worn camera program. what we would need to do to get there. What our police recruiting strategy is. Michael and I think recently as last week, had a conversation about being very intentional in our recruiting efforts so that we can further diversify our police department. And I believe he has the heart to do that to do that citywide. So this isn't just a police department goal. But I think there's ways to be, again, very intentional in that effort. And then there was one more that I didn't put on here that I think dovetails into this, and that really is our internal accountability with our internal affairs professional standards process. What we do hold officers accountable while we protect their due process rights when a complaint comes in against one of our officers. So I think those are all public concern. I will kind of leave it at that. If there's interest in any of those, I'm happy to come back at a future date. But as I'm working on my end to be more transparent and accountable to the public, I think these are issues that really dovetail nicely into that, and having our legislative body have an understanding of that, and then the community that may be listening. I think that that's important, especially now. It's always been important, but especially now it's important to have that information out there so that there's at least some confidence. But as Michael said at the beginning, also just if there's a pushback, if there's areas where maybe we need to revisit, maybe we need to strengthen something up, maybe we need to change a practice. I'll just share with you that I'm always open to that. Our policies are living documents. I can't tell you the number of revisions to even our use of force policy over the last 2 years. We keep coming back as things change and as information changes. So with that, I will pause and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Just a second, Vince. John Steckler has been here, and he was here for audience communication. I don't know if he just checked out. I saw his name come across the screen, but he has been here. So anyway, Vincent, you had a comment?
Thanks, Mayor. Scott, I was I know how these nuts and bolts works in other agencies. Our use of force board, who is that comprised of?
Councilmember Cavalieri, I'd have to look at it again. The good news is we haven't had to do one in the last 2.5 years. I believe it is compiled of our master DT instructor. That would be Bobby Phillips. I think it has a sergeant on it. I believe it's chaired generally by the deputy chief. And then it has an outside agency representative on it. I think that's about 95% close, but I haven't looked at it in a little while.
And that actually sounds about right. And for public consumption, that goes towards the confidence of it's not just a rubber stamp of cops reviewing cops. It's members of the community, members of the command staff, even elected bodies in some cases. So I think that is something, if we're going to have this conversation, that I would like to make sure that we are crossing that broad spectrum of individuals who will do these reviews, but they have to have a degree of, you know, expertise. They just cannot just be, you know, members of a community group, and that's the end of it. I'm here to make a decision. So, and that's where a lot of cities have gone wrong, Baltimore, New York, just to name a couple, where they have put civil review, CRBs is what they call them, civil review boards that pass judgment without ever understand all the nuances that go in to law enforcement and the use of force practices. And that would transcend to an education piece to the public that would be entirely helpful all the way around.
Yeah, and I think that would fit in nicely if we talk about our professional standards, talking about the use of force review board at that same time. I think that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Mark, did you have your hand up?
I did. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Chief, for taking a pretty complicated issue and answering the questions and doing it in a manner that was reasonably brief and informative. I appreciate the work that went into this. I just want to say for the folks that are listening, when you look, it's really difficult to address this issue of police reform and whatnot when you're trying to compare Louisiana to Florida to Arkansas to California to Chicago to Mill Creek. I can't vouch or verify what is going on in law enforcement in other states and cities, but Mill Creek and Snohomish County and Washington State have been ahead of this game. Not that we don't have work to do. We've got work to do. We're committed to doing it. And the chief's message was there. It's a living document. We'll evolve. We'll criticize ourselves. We'll learn from our mistakes. We'll learn from the mistakes of other cities. But there's a notion out there that we're not being trained in de-escalation. We're not being trained in how to deal with the mentally ill. And that's just not true in this state, in Snohomish County, and specifically Mill Creek as well. We get some pretty good training with regards to de-escalation and how to work with the mentally ill, sensitivity to minority groups and whatnot. And not saying there's not more to do, and I'm willing to do more, but we are doing pretty darn good here and getting the word out to the communities we serve as to what we're doing and how we're doing it. And messages like what you put together tonight help to achieve that. And I just want to say thank you. It was well done.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions for the chief? Okay, seeing none. And by the way, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I'm listening to council members Cavallari and Bond because this is in their wheelhouse. But Chief, thank you for a great report. As far as I'm concerned, it sounds like we're doing the right kind of things. And I think we have confirmation of that from council members Bond and Cavallari, who understand the terminology. I concur with what Councilmember Bond said, is that you hear about this stuff across the nation. What's kind of scary is we hear about it, also scary things in Seattle or Tacoma, which are neighboring cities. And I felt confidence that our Mill Creek police force operates in a different fashion than some of the things we've seen on local news. But if I can get Councilmember Bond to take his great statements, but could you take off your sheriff hat for a second and put on just purely your council member hat? Are there things that you think we should be digging deeper into? Because I'll say that I think what I just heard from Chief Eastman is we're in good shape. We should not rest on our laurels, but I think we're in good shape. But are there things that, as a council member and your expertise, you would say, here's the next step we ought to work on? Because Chief's already said we're working on, this is a continued evolving thing. Sorry, Mark, go ahead.
Yes. So I think we should listen to our officers and their command staff. And if they do make requests and say, for instance, training. When I first came on 2003, they were going to have tasers. We're going to have tasers and you would check them out. So a person would come in, there'd maybe be five tasers for 15 people or whatever. We would check them out. And I made an argument that I did not think that would be a good idea, that we should fund a taser for each officer to take home, maintain, and again, just a use of force option. But I would hate to have an officer out there that might be able to use a lower level of force, not have it available, and then have to escalate. A little example, but listening to what our staff is saying they might need, I will say I really do believe in my heart that Mill Creek is outstanding. One of the advantages that they have is they're not a 100-year-old city. We're a very young city. We don't have years of institutionalized, and I don't want to use the word corruption. I think that's too much. But the city of Seattle has been around forever. The people that train the new guys were trained by the old guard. And so sometimes some bad habits get passed down. And we didn't have that 100 years of culture, 200 years. We have we're a very young city, and I think we are much more modern in our thinking and approach to the problems that the police address in their community. And we don't have we're not entrenched in old school ways of thinking. We've got a lot of fairly young, new, even our leadership is up to speed on the training that is what is consistently accepted as where we should be today for most of us. And there's this, you know, in movies, you see the movies, the guy tries to hurt a cop and they drag him behind a building and they beat him up and they rough him up a little. And it makes for a great movie, but that's just not what's going on. We're not doing that. It's what makes us better than the people we arrest. If we lower ourselves to that level, we're no better than them. And we should be in jail just like them. I've said before, and I mean it, and I believe the Mill Creek officers that I know would share this. I don't care if George Floyd just shot up the police department and the only reason he surrendered was because he ran out of bullets. When the fight's over, it's over. The job of the police at that point is to bring him before the justice system and allow him due process. We don't decide whether it's time for him to lose life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. A jury of his peers and the judge make that decision. Our obligation is to protect the people we bring into custody and make sure they don't die and get them before a judge and a jury and let them make those decisions, period, end of story. And that's where those folks failed. George Floyd, good, bad. Some people have tried to make it sound like, well, George Floyd was a bad guy. Who cares? Doesn't matter. He gets to have due process. We all deserve due process. And that's where ultimately we horribly failed him. We denied him due process. The police that were involved in that incident denied him due process by allowing him to die, either by their own acts or by a careless indifference. It doesn't matter. It was wrong.
Okay, Mike, did you have anything else?
Well, I was going to say to the chief, he kind of put the question out there. Would we like to hear about body-worn cameras, police recruiting strategy, and the last one was internal accountability, I think is what he called it. I'm all for that. I think these are topics that I don't fully understand. I think our citizens would like us as council to understand those and know we're doing the right thing. I'm sure we are. Just I think the chief and his guys are doing a great job. But I think it'd be good for the public and for us to hear about those. So is when we have time available and the chief wants to do it, I'm all for hearing from those topics. I'm just one, but I think it'd be a great idea to carry on with those. Thanks.
Hey, Mike, Vincent? Can I add? Thanks, Mayor. Councilmember Todd put a great point out there is, you know, what does the public want to hear and what do they want to know? And it's important. One of the things I would like to see, I mean, I'm really glad we're having this conversation first, but what happened out there on the street of a Minneapolis street that day was, is those of us that wear a uniform is never acceptable to any degree whatsoever. And matter of fact, the level of indifference, I think, outrageous, and to go even further, embarrasses all of us that have any good in our bones. What I would always hope to see out of this is that I would like to see, if we're looking at policy changes, that, and I'm sure every law enforcement official in Mill Creek would understand that the duty to act, the duty to intervene in those moments is not something that's subjective. It has to be automatic. We have to understand. I mean, and I'm not trying to pick agencies. The sheriff's office is very good about teaching us that if you're not tapping the guy on the shoulder or pulling him off or saying, hey, it's my turn, let me take over, I got him, I'll finish this off here, then you're neglecting your duty. And I want that to be a reflection at some point, whatever policy changes we make, because had that happened in Minneapolis, we're not even having this conversation. And so that is the big one, you know, failing to act, being indifferent is not acceptable. It's where I stand, and I know the most 99% of us would stand that wear a uniform. Thank you.
Sorry, Stephanie.
I just wanna to add on and thank Chief for his presentation, because we are asking these questions. The citizens are residents are asking the questions of us. And I really appreciate the time that it took for him to compile all this for everyone and come on here and and walk us through everything in a way that we can understand. And I also want to add on to what Councilmember Todd said. I would love to hear more regarding the body cameras and other options in the future for us to have a study session on those items whenever is appropriate for us to do so. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else?
Mayor,
yeah?
Mayor, if I might, I just I want to make, I may have glossed over it, but that the FAQ and the letter that I wrote is all on our city website. So I just want the public to know that it's there. They can check that out. Our goal is to have our use of force policy attached to that as well, so that that's also available. And I don't remember if it was Councilmember Bond or Cavalieri, but I don't think that the state really gets enough credit for what we were already doing as a result of I-940. The state already had the law in effect about independent investigations. It already had the requirement for de-escalation training. It already had the requirement for patrol tactics training. We were already doing all these things long before Minneapolis. And so I think that the state really should take some pride in that, that a lot of the things that other states are being, they're kind of on their heels because they're reacting. We're actually proactive. And the Mill Creek Police Department is certainly one of the beneficiaries of that work.
Thank you. Michael?
Thank you, Mayor and members of council. Just very quickly, I was going to add on to Chief Eastman's statement that the Washington state model is something that's actually being actively referred to by other jurisdictions. In speaking with my professional contacts, both in the Midwest and the East Coast, this is something that's very actively being considered as long overdue in other places. It's one of the things that is makes it a pleasure to work in the Pacific Northwest is the progressive nature of the police work. And frankly, I want to speak for a moment about the police officers in the city of Mill Creek. I did recently, in the past few months, have a chance to interview at length the supermajority of the police officers on the force. They are very articulate when it comes to constitutional law. They believe in the restraints that are inherent in police powers, and they're very, very clear about their boundaries. I'm really proud to work with this team. They're natural-born constitutionalists, and they don't just mouth. They don't just talk the talk. I've observed them in firsthand situations, as I mentioned earlier, just how they managed the protesters, permitting them and actually encouraging them to exercise their First Amendment rights. It's a very exciting thing to work with this department, with their level of professionalism and their constitutionalism. I think we're in really good hands, and I'm very proud to be a part of this team. Thank you.
Okay, Vincent?
And just real quick, Michael brought up a very interesting and unique point that when we talked about, or we've been talking about, proactive policing, take something like social workers that all the communities across the country are speaking about. We've been doing that for 3 years. They have been embedded with the deputies out on the road and in the communities for 3 years now, and night in and night out, they are an intricate part in carrying out not just the law enforcement piece, but the community service piece. And the same goes for the resources for the homelessness. And Snohomish County, the last year or two, as far as a resource for our veterans, I'll tell you this, if we interact with a veteran, there is not one night that has to go by that we can't find him a house or a place to stay, clothing, food, etc., unless he does not want it. So very proud of all those things we're doing with the Sheriff's Office, and they are rubbing off on all the existing agencies around us, Mill Creek, Linwood, Bothell, etc. So great points, everybody, and I think we're all on board that this is our goal, is that community policing is exactly that, public safety with compassion. Thanks.
Hi, John. John has joined us. John, I know you were listening. Did you have any comments to make, or?
You're muted.
Okay. John, did you have any comments to make?
No, I'm just trying to get a microphone to work.
Okay.
It does now.
Good deal. He's been on since he said audience communication. So,
yeah, I've been on,
however,
it's kind of like being in the afterlife. I could see you, but you couldn't see me, and I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me. It's been hell the whole time.
Okay, thanks. Okay, any more comments on this? Seeing none, we will move along to our next study session item, and that's a request for a perpetual sight line easement on the Remlard property. Michael?
Thank you, Mayor. I've had the occasion to meet Mr. Daniel Carr, at least by telephone, during the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our process had slowed down because of the prohibition against the public meetings. We have worked, though, to pick up steam, and that's the purpose for our evening, our meeting here this evening. A binding site plan has been submitted to develop the property located on the southeast corner of North Creek Drive and Dumas Road intersection. And with us this evening to present is City Planner Sherry Ringstead and Planning Manager Tom Rogers. Sherry and Tom?
Sherry, you're muted.
Thank you. I'm back. Can you see my screen?
We can. We need it enlarged if possible, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let's go.
Okay. Thank you and good evening, City Council. As the mayor mentioned, this is consideration of a perpetual vehicular sightline easement for the Seven Seas Swim School. I'd like to start with an aerial vicinity map to get you oriented. The road that's running diagonally up on the bottom right corner, that wide road, is the Buffalo Everett Highway. Dumas Road takes off to the west. There's the intersection with North Creek Drive. The Seven Seas property is outlined in blue. And directly across North Creek Drive are the Heatherwood Apartments. And then across Dumas Road to the northeast are the Montero Apartments. And adjoining the property to the south is city-owned property. You know it as the Remillard property. And you can see the access to the site is down there in the southwest corner. And it's directly across from the Heatherwood Southern access. And when North Creek Drive was constructed, they planned for this to be the access. They actually put in a curb cut right here. So this is the most logical place to have an access. I'd like to start with a little background. Mr. Carr with Seven Seas Swim School has purchased this property with the intent of constructing a recreational building that will house a swim school. And as you saw on the vicinity map, the access needs to be across from the Heatherwood Southern entrance. But this does create a site distance issue to the south. To the south, there's a fence that's on the Remillard property, and there's some vegetation right in the corner that create a vehicular site distance issue. And as a result, Mr. Carr is requesting that the council consider granting a vehicular site distance easement on the Remillard property. And the RCWs state that the council is the body that would approve granting an easement. A quick look at the review process to date. The applicant actually submitted their binding site plan application in September of 2019. There were a number of issues with the site to work out. There were some issues with the wetland and the buffer averaging. There were some drainage issues. So it went back and forth several times between the applicant and the city's engineering consultant, Pertit. But then on May of this year, 2020, the applicant submitted plans that were compliant with city code, so we could proceed with the review process, and we did issue the SEPA threshold determination on May 6th. The hearing examiner held a public hearing on June 16th and issued a decision on June 30th. And the design review board will be reviewing the building elevations and the landscaping at their regular meeting in July, which is next week, July 16. And then the section in the middle with the green, that's council's portion. This evening at the work session, the idea is to get from council some direction on what you would consider to be appropriate compensation for the easement. And the next step then would be for the city attorney to draft a resolution authorizing the city manager to sign the easement and also to draft the formal easement itself. And that would come back at a future council meeting for action. And we're hoping that it can come back at your next meeting on the 14th. And the last part of the review process will be review of the civil plans. They have submitted their plans. They're currently under review. They've been forwarded to Pertit for review. And site work on the site cannot begin until they do have their civil plans approved and until the easement is settled. And that was a condition of the binding site plan approval. Here's a site plan. You can see right here sort of in the center and then off to the northeast, there's a large wetland and then a wetland buffer that constrains the site, the development on the site. So the development is down towards the southern boundary. You can see the access here out to North Creek Drive. This shows the site distance easement. The yellow is the easement or the site distance that needs to be achieved for a safe access onto North Creek Drive. And you can see it cuts across the Remillard property, just a little triangle on the edge of the Remillard property. And here's a close-up of the Remillard property, and it shows where the easement would need to be. That's shown in yellow down on the bottom, that triangle in yellow. The blue line that goes across, this is the right-of-way line. When the city Remillard property develops, they will be required to dedicate right-of-way. And right-of-way could contain a parking strip, sidewalk, landscaping. No structures are allowed in the right-of-way. The things that can go in the right-of-way would not likely impede site distance. So really the, whoops, sorry. There we go, sorry. That little triangle at the top, 661 square feet, that's the part where the city would have some limitations on development. The total easement area is 1,337 square feet. The part that's within the right-of-way is 726 square feet. And then the part that's most impacted is the 661 square feet.
Jerry, can I ask a question?
Yes, sure, go ahead.
Go ahead, Brian.
This is Brian. Can you go back to the prior map?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you can see, the question I have is, the majority of the property that this easement would cover will eventually have to dedicate as right-of-way to ourselves for a public road. But I'm just looking here. I can't, it's hard to see on the computer screen, but I have it up on my iPad. It looks like at its widest width outside of the right-of-way, it's 17.75 feet on the north side. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah, that looks about right.
So you made the comment. My main concern with this was whether it would have any impact on our future development of the property. This, doesn't the city have a setback requirement from the edge of the right-of-way? So when we go to develop, we would have to dedicate this 8.5 feet to complete the frontage improvements across North Creek Drive. But then aren't we going to have a setback requirement that limits what we can do within a certain distance of that right-of-way line?
It kind of depends on what's developed there. There is no setback in some instances. If it were, say, a commercial building, they would be able to go all the way up to the right-of-way.
A commercial building ended out in this zone. So in this zone, what is the setback requirement?
Let's see. You know what? I'm not sure. I think the Remillard property is zoned office park. The Kelly property is zoned community business. Maybe
there is
ask Tom.
Yeah, there is a setback requirement. I think it's either 15 or 20 feet. The only reason that there is
a possibility that someone could come right up to the right-of-way is if they had ground floor retail per the code. There is a provision that does allow that. It's not very likely given the traffic on the street and what is around it and what is developed across the street and such. So it's not a very likely impact. What would typically be there if the right-of-way is there would be probably a little bit of landscaping and some sort of parking or something, especially if it goes to some sort of a park use or a community center. But there is a theoretical potential that you could put something up there, sell the property, and they would want to put like a storefront, kind of a commercial use right up the front.
Would this easement preclude us from having parking within that easement, site distance easement?
Probably, because it's going to be over the height. You have to look through the cars. We'd have to sort of look to see exactly where it is. It could.
Well, that to me is the key question of whether or not, if there's a setback that would limit us to doing anything within that setback, then this is, to me, a non-issue. But it doesn't sound like we have a definitive answer on that right now.
Well, let me look in the code real quick and find out exactly what the setback is and get right back to you.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom. Can I go ahead and go on, and then we'll let Tom get back to us on that?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Here's a couple of photos. The photo on the left is on North Creek Drive, looking towards the Heatherwood Apartments. It's right adjacent to the Remillard property. The fence that you see in the photo is on the Remillard property. And the fence is actually non-conforming. If it were built today, it wouldn't be allowed to be built that close to the road, but the fence was there long before the road. And the trees that you see right in the corner there are ones that would have to be removed to clear the site distance. It looks like one, but there's actually a group of three cedars right in that triangular corner. And then the photo on the right is in the curb cut, in the driveway cut for the Kelly property or the 7C Swim School property. The fence that you see behind the light is on the Remillard property. And you can see the site distance issue here because you can't see any traffic coming up the road. That's why that triangle needs to be cleared out. It's definitely a safety issue. The impacts, there's short-term impacts and long-term impacts. The short-term impacts, currently there is a fence there. So if you remove the fence, theoretically it does make the property more vulnerable to unauthorized access. And there's vegetation that would have to be removed to be able to clear the site distance. And the long-term impacts would be limiting the land uses that would block views in the easement area. It doesn't totally limit the use of the easement area. It just limits uses that would block the easement. This is the part where we're asking for council direction, some staff recommendations on potential terms. The city attorney did identify that it is appropriate for the council to require some compensation for the easement. And what staff is suggesting, an appraisal was recently done for the diocese property. And this was for a sewer line easement, which is a very similar type of easement. And the property was valued at $5.50 a square foot. So when you take that 1,337 square foot easement by the 550, that equals $7,353. And this could be requested as a condition for the applicant to compensate the city. Other compensation or mitigation that we would recommend, the fence does need to be removed. Right now, there's quite a bit of vegetation right in that corner. There's salal and blackberries. So the trees would have to be removed. The existing vegetation would have to be removed. And that triangle would have to be graded so that the site distance would be open. Where the public works staff, I consulted with them, and they recommended that, this site distance triangle, we don't want it just to become a maintenance issue. where it has to be maintained constantly. So what they recommended after the site is graded, that it be finished with a river rock or cobble to keep the weeds down. And as mentioned earlier, the actual likelihood that the city would use this easement area for a use that would impede the site distance is really pretty minimal. It's not likely that the development that's taller would be pushed all the way up to the Seven Seas property and all the way up to the right of way.
Sherry, I have a question.
Sure.
So if the fence was there before the road, so we get to keep the fence because it's grandfathered in. If you take the fence down, can we put another fence up?
Well, what you could do is you could put the fence up along the eastern boundary of that site distance triangle. So the fence would be kind of moved in. It would go at an angle from the Seven Seas property out to the existing fence on North Creek Drive where it's outside of the easement triangle.
And so that would allow us to keep the area secure so that we're not having people going in there and camping?
Yes. It is important to note, too, though, that there is a fence there right now, but not along the entire frontage on North Creek Drive. There's an access drive that runs through the Dobson property up to the Remillard property and out to North Creek. So there's two big sections of fence where the road comes in and out, where, you know, there's complete access to the site. So if somebody wanted to get in there, they could. And part of the frontage along Dobson is not fenced at all. So at this point, I'm not going to say it's a completely secure site, but it's, you know, there's a visual impairment.
But even though we're taking down a grandfathered fence, we can require a new fence be put up.
We could. Oh, and yes, the reason that it's non-conforming is because it's too close to the roadway. So if they're putting the fence in along the edge of the easement, it's going to be farther back and it wouldn't be non-conforming except for when it where it comes right up to the road.
Okay, thank you. Vincent? Vincent?
Sorry. Thanks, Mayor. I want to go back to what Councilmember Hostclaw said a moment ago. So I guess I'll address it to Brian. Does this kind of, would this handcuff the city going forward for our uses? Is that where we're going with this?
I don't think so. I mean, we're talking ultimately about 660 square feet. So maybe, I mean, the most likely use I think we'd have down here is some potential to have the edge of parking. So I do think the impact's likely going to be minimal, especially if Tom confirms there's a setback under our code that we would be required to not build in anyway. I do have one more question, Sherry, because doesn't this issue arise because we're trying to line up the entrance to this proposed development with the entrance to the Heatherwood Apartments?
And I'm sorry, could you restate? I missed the beginning.
Isn't this site distance an issue because we are trying to align the entrance to this development with the entrance to Heatherwood Apartments? Because if you could... Can you go back to attachment two that shows the site plan, shows their site plan with the triangles. There you go. So that driveway,
this one?
Yes, that one. Because if the driveway is moved up to the north, nope, you were on it.
The aerial photograph.
The site plan that you were on.
Okay, go back.
Okay, so the site plan, which is this one, right?
You're just on it.
Page two, I believe, Sherry.
There's site
this
plan
one?
That has the site.
The one that has the close-up of the easement?
Yo, there you go.
No, there's one you just had up a second ago. It's attachment two in one of our packets that has the two site distance triangles on it.
Yeah, this one right here.
No, there's another one that is that site. There we go. Yes, that one. So if we move the access road up to the north, it makes the site distance problem worse. But what if we move it down to the south? I mean, is it possible to grant a deviation from our road standards to move that entrance road down closer to the property line? Because it seems like that would make the site distance issue less, or am I playing too much of an engineer? Would it be exacerbating it from the other direction?
Tom, I'm going to let you take this one.
I'm unmuted. Okay, so a couple of things is we looked at that and didn't really make much of a difference. We talked to, several months ago when we were evaluating all these, we had the applicant actually prepare several different alternatives. This makes the most sense. It doesn't really make a difference on the side angle. If you move it up anywhere to the north, what happens is that the grade gets too steep for the fire department, so the driveway goes further to the site and the area you can go up is much smaller. So this is really the only place it can be that lines up for supervisors directly across from Heatherwood site.
But that's my question. Does it need to be across from Heatherwood?
Yes.
Yes, that's the logical place for it to be.
Why? I mean, with the site distance issue with that curve, I can't imagine we would want cars shooting across North Creek Drive from the Heatherwood apartments to get into this driveway. It seems an alternative would be to move the driveway entrance to the south and put up some kind of barrier in the middle of the road. Do we want cars crossing across from Heatherwood apartments, taking a straight shot into here? That's how I got hit on a bike up on 527 a couple years ago with exactly that situation.
My understanding in working with the engineering staff of the city is that it is better to have the drivers be able to look at each other when they're coming out at the same time and can coordinate, and so they're not, so it's a coordinated entrance in and out, and that moving it to the south doesn't, it would just confuse that, and it doesn't really improve the side angle. When you take the area that is going to be opened up, there shouldn't be any shooting anywhere. You should be able to see through, you know, given the situation, there shouldn't be an unsafe condition, and that's why they're asking for the easement.
Yeah, I'm not questioning the need for an easement, and I don't think it's going to have much impact. I'm just making sure we've evaluated the option of how necessary it is it to have it align, because what's the distance from the southern entrance of their proposed driveway down to the property line? 30 feet? I can't tell from the scale of the map.
I can't see it either. I don't have the plans in front of me working remotely.
I mean, it wouldn't be a huge offset, but
we did have the engineer show us three different alternatives, including that, as well as moving it up north. And this is the only place that really made any sense and was supported by our engineering staff.
Okay. I wanted to make sure you guys have thought through all the options. Thank you.
And then as far as the setback, I did find that, and the setback is 15 feet minimum from the sidewalk or the property line, whichever is greater. And then there is an exception to have it between 10 and 0 feet if it's a commercial use on the ground floor. Given the zoning and its location, it's probably not likely to be commercial. So we think the chances are minimal, but there is that theoretical potential.
So given the uses that we are currently contemplating, considering, this would have, I mean, that 661 square feet, if there's approximately 15-foot setback, we're talking a fraction of that.
You right. Are, and you also have a 10-foot buffer along the north property line of our property. Generally, you put the landscaping next to each other, sort of that's the general practice. So you're going to have some distance even further, so it's a little bit even less of an impact.
Yeah, so that just verifies this. I don't think this is going to have an impact at all on whatever we may do with the property unless we completely do something different and decide to sell it for an office use, which I'm not voting for.
Mike Todd.
Madam Mayor, thank you. So I'm going to pursue that a little bit longer. So if presumably there could be parking in that location with a 15-foot setback, Tom, but you're saying it could be reduced, but could you not park in that site distance area? I guess that's the question. Are we going to lose a car parking place or two?
Matt, are you on the call? I guess not. So we don't have the engineering staff here, but I don't know exactly what the height requirement is, and I apologize for not knowing that. But if you're sitting in a car, and if you could see over the car, then that would be fine. So I don't know
exactly. Generally, your hood of your car, you know, I guess if it's an old Toyota van, it's square and straight up. I mean, I don't know what the assumptions are, but you probably, to be safe, you probably leave enough room to make sure that it's a safe situation.
So you might lose a couple of parking spaces or have to go with compact spaces there or something.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I have a question. Is this in any way going to affect anything we might decide to do with the Cook property?
Not at all.
No. Not at all. So we're the Cook property is far enough away that nothing we do on this side of the road is going to affect that side of the road.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. Just checking. Better to check now than later.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Brian, do you have anything else? Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
I think the applicant is also on the line, and he may want to make a couple comments to the council if it's at the pleasure of the mayor and if the council. Also, when you're done discussing it.
Vincent, do you have your hand up? You're muted, Vincent.
Sorry, I was just trying to turn my volume up. Thank you, though, Mayor.
Here, Councilman, question.
Mike Todd?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so I think I'll try to lead this off. I think I am generally in feeling we should approve this. I think the issue is that we want to make sure that, it sounds like we would like to make sure that fence is reconnected along that sight line, as Sherry described. I think we would need to agree to let them remove the trees, have them grade that triangle as necessary, and put in some sort of landscaping material or rocks so that the vegetation doesn't grow up and be a problem for us. I'm for all those things. I think the real question is, what's that cost of the easement? As I understand it from staff, the $550 was a very recent appraisal of an easement. That's not the full price of the land, but that's what an easement would be. It's kind of half the price of the land, because this is not selling it to them. It's giving them the right to have us not put some structure on there. So I'm along the lines of saying this is something I'd be willing to talk about. And I think the trick is really, is it the easement that's just the triangle that we can't use, or is it the easement that is in the entire 1337 square feet, which also includes the right of way? Once we develop that property, if we'd already developed it, the right of way would not be ours. And so I think there's some debate that council could have about whether the number is 1337 or whether it's 661 or some compromise in between in terms of what the value is that we're going to allow to be taken away from the for the value of our property. Thanks.
Okay. Brian, do you have anything to add?
No, I concur with Mike.
Okay. So, Michael, what's our next step? The Planning Commission meets on Wednesday, and then we bring it back next week?
That's correct, Mayor.
Subject to all the comments that Brian and Mike Todd have made?
That's correct. I also want to interject that Matthew Feely got disconnected, and he's struggling to get back in. And so we will just be responsive to Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw's question relating to the engineering before the next council meeting. I'll also say that we have our interim city attorney, Grant Degginger, on the call. We've been taking notes and communicating back and forth. So we have what we need to draft both the easement and the resolution.
Yeah, Mayor, if I could interject one question for council, and that is the question that council member Todd posed, which is at this point in time, the direction that staff would need would also be whether the council at this time wants to focus on the valuation of the 661 permanent square feet rather than the 1,337 square feet that is the total amount of the easement, which then the city will then be relinquishing as you develop the property or the arterial there.
We'll debate that next week. We put in a blank for the amount.
We could do that.
Is there some consensus on the council on which direction to go?
This is Councilmember Todd. I'll throw it out there. I think that is indeed something we could debate next week. And I think we're saying, Councilmember Holzclaw might be saying, okay, let's debate 550 times 661 or 550 times 1337. We can get a decision on that. I would like people to consider that we are asking the applicant to replace our fence, bear the cost of taking out those trees, make it so it's not a maintenance nightmare for us. So there's some cost there, and I'm willing to consider that as part of his compensation towards making this all work in the terms of partnership. And I think one reason that's important for me to we talk about this now and get it done is that if the hearing examiner and the design review board and all the reviews that go on are favorable, I would like very much to have help this developer complete his project within the good building season. So I thank everybody for thinking about this ahead of time, being ready to make a decision so that we're not the critical path. It's to the benefit of the city and the developer if he gets his project in the ground faster than slower. So I encourage us to be ready to talk about this next week when it's in front of us. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're waiting for we'll wait for the Planning Commission and to come back next week.
And just to clarify, it's not actually going to the Planning Commission. This is a decision for the council. So all we're waiting for is next week we can bring you back a resolution, a draft easement that the city attorney can prepare, and we can maybe leave that blank on the amount of compensation. And you could finish your discussion next week, and then we could fill in the blank.
Okay, does that work for the council? I'm seeing thumbs up. Okay, that's what we'll do, Sherry.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for your patience tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so now we're up to the consent agenda, and we're going to pull this one more time. We'll bring it back next week. Which takes us down to reports. And my only report is that we are not getting into phase three, it looks like, anytime soon. Brian, you were probably right. It may be Labor Day. Our metric numbers were allowed 25 new cases per 100,000. And as of today, we're at 53. So, and we're off on two other metrics too. Hopefully wearing the masks will help. But if it doesn't, we're going to be in phase two for a long time. Dr. Spitters did an interview today, and he expects us to be dealing with the virus and the consequences of it for another year or two. So we'll see what happens, but I've been doing my best to get us to phase three, but with the numbers increasing, we're just not going to get there. So not anytime soon. So we'll see where it goes. Mark Bond, any reports?
No report.
Okay. Councilmember Steckler?
Councilmember Todd and Vignelle and I all attended the AWC conference last week, and Councilmember Todd has taken the time to put together a written recap of it that I think I'm going to defer my comments to him so that we can kind of have a discussion as a group, but we have some ideas and some thoughts to share with the council that we learned from that. So I'll probably like to chime in more after he's had a chance to update the council on some of the topics that were discussed and the opportunities that were presented.
Yeah, and as you and I and the city manager and Jeff discussed yesterday, we'll be doing a full presentation on the CARES Act at our July 14th meeting.
Excellent.
So we'll be doing a whole presentation. Anything else?
Not for me, no.
Hey, Councilmember Cavallari, any reports?
Thanks, Mayor, but no reports. But, well, I tell you what, I do have a report. The Parks Board did meet via Zoom meeting, and it was eventful, to say the least, and we have agreed for the month of August to do our annual parks tour. This way, since it is a biennium budget season, to make the appropriate recommendations for financing for the upgrades or repairs for parks. But after that, my motion would be I would like to restore council meetings back into City Hall and on the council dais. I think the emergency state and the emergency nature and the safety protocols in place would allow us a very safe way of delivering our government to the people. So that'll be my motion for now, and I have more to expand on if I can get a second.
Okay, seeing no second. Right now, we're still limited to 5 people, Vince.
I'm seconding. I just had a mute.
Okay. Councilmember Cavallari, Councilmember Holtzclaw? Brian, did you have something to say?
Not yet. Are we in discussion?
So all right, go ahead.
Vince, if you want to go, and then Brian can go.
Okay. Thanks, Mayor. So I think that technology has brought us to the point where, regardless of our numbers, there's no special number in the room, that there's a square footage caveat there as well, because there are enough one or two folks that if they are in the vulnerable population or they are for whatever reason still fearful, that they can attend the meetings via Zoom. I'm a believer. I don't like this informal process of, and I never have, of these whole Zoom meetings. I think we take away from the public's access to its government, and it's not something that has ever sat well with me. I'm doing it. I'm willing to keep doing it, but like I said, I made the motion, and I'm hoping that we have enough folks that are willing to show up and give the public access to its government, and we can do it safely. It exists. There are parameters to work around, and I would even give it a couple of weeks to say the third week. Not the third week, the fourth week, the last meeting before the break. So that's
okay,
my discussion.
Brian Holtzclaw?
I, for one, am not going to support that, and I don't know how we can vote on a motion with parameters for operating the meeting safely without knowing what any of those parameters are. I don't even know if it's technologically possible to have some people in the room and others not in the room, all participating in the Zoom call. I know I'm not comfortable going down there and participating in a large meeting with a large gathering. So I frankly think it'd be irresponsible of us to do that. So I'm not going to be supporting this motion.
Okay, anybody else have something? Mike Todd?
Yeah, thanks. I can appreciate that. We all feel hampered by Zoom. We're missing the 90% of the communication that are beyond the words we say. The way our body language is going and where we're looking in the room is something that's hampered. And I've mentioned that before. And I also concur that Zoom meetings are not the way to conduct the public's business. But I'm not going to support this motion because we have a state guidance from our governor. I'm going to uphold that says we're not allowed to meet more than 5 people. So until we're in phase 3 or beyond, I don't think we're physically able to do that. And so even if a few council members wanted to show up, and if you didn't, as was suggested for those of us who are age discriminated against by doing so, we don't know how we would deal with if 15 people from the public showed up. I'm not sure that we have the capacity or the square footage or the technology to accommodate those folks with an overflow room and another overflow room and the video and the audio. So technically, I think it's difficult, and it's against the governor's proclamation, which I think we're still under. So I'm going to vote no. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, and I agree. It's not safe yet. We are limited by law. It looks like we're going to be limited for a while. And I think we actually have more participation, at least with the people I see calling in. And most of the other mayors are saying that they're just getting a lot more people participating via these electronic meetings. I don't like them at all. I'd like to be in the room with you all. But we can't do that until it's safe. And there is a proclamation saying no now. So I'm with Brian and Mike. And Mark Bond, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mayor. So I don't support it because we don't have enough of the pieces of the puzzle to move forward with how we intend to do it. But I support the notion that we need to be thinking about that, getting ready to move forward. The idea, well, one, it sounds like if we wear masks, then everything's fixed, if you believe some people. Two, the casinos are in operation and nail salons are in operation and grocery stores have never closed and we can all buy marijuana whenever we want to, but we are limiting access to local government and the effectiveness by doing it this way. So I see some wisdom in trying to better interact with the community that we serve. This is working for now, but it's not ideal. So I understand where Councilmember Cavallari is coming from, and when it maybe we can bring some ideas together for when it is appropriate, how do we do it? Do we have shields between us? Do we all wear masks and face guards and gloves? But I think if the casinos can answer this question, we probably could too. Thank you.
And Jeff will be doing a presentation on this next week as part of our CARES Act presentation. Brian, then Vince.
Yeah, I completely agree with Vince in terms of this is not ideal. I guess what I would ask is that if we're still in this situation after our August recess, I think between now and then we should be looking at fleshing out what parameters might look like so we could consider if we were to start having in-person meetings or having that option, that we've thought through what would be the requirements and the parameters, how could people participate if they didn't want to come in person, what would be required. You know, we have seating issues if, you know, the dance doesn't meet the 6-foot physical distancing requirements. So I don't know how we could have all of us up there in the dais, but I think if we could look at those issues and come up with a plan so that if we still are in this situation come the beginning of September, we have something more concrete that we could look at to consider whether we're able to move forward.
Thank you. Vince?
All right, so I did have more to say. I thought given if we gave it the fourth week of July to try to roll it out, I thought it would be fair and would probably work. It's been working for the private community and private businesses that have to get their employees back to work. I don't see why it would work for government. Wouldn't work for government to some degree. So again, you have my motion. It's out there. I appreciate the discussion. I appreciate everybody hearing it. Again, I'll stand by what I put down there. I think it's necessary. I think it's about time. There's plenty of safe ways to do it, and there's plenty of time between now and then to figure it out, especially with technology being what it is. Thanks, Mayor.
Okay, Mike Todd?
This may be a question for our city attorney. My understanding of the proclamation for the governor is he has suspended the requirements for the OPMA because of the COVID restrictions. When we move to a different phase whereby we are no longer under that exception, we will have to have public meetings and we will have to meet in person once again. But I think this all rolls down to us from the governor's proclamation 2028 and the amendments there too. But I'm not exactly sure where in the phases that the 2028.5 or wherever we are, where does that line up with phases? If we get to phase four, or do we have to go back to in-person meetings? And is that the timing on this? Is this driven by the governor? That's a question for somebody who knows.
I'll take a shot at it, Council Member. This is Grant Degenger. The answer is that the proclamation doesn't lay out in the phasing specifically when that would happen. If the proclamation is no longer applicable because it usually has a date certain by which it ends and it has to be renewed, then that would be the timing that the council would need. Certainly. There are going to be some steps along the way about how you can accomplish that over time and how you might physically accommodate any ongoing obligations for social distancing within the meeting room. So good question. I don't think the two are necessarily linked to the phases, but we can certainly look and see further if there's any additional guidance to be received from the governor's office.
Okay. Brian, did you have your hand up? Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
Is John Steckler here? There he is. Okay. So it looks like any abstentions? So it looked like it failed 6-1 with Council Member Cavallari voting yes. So next is Council Member Vignelle. Do you have any report?
Thank you, Mayor. Like Council Member Steckler said, I also participated in the AWC conference online, which was an interesting thing to do online. I really appreciate the effort they put into it. We actually had breakout rooms within Zoom, which I think was a very effective way to have smaller conversations, and I really appreciated that. We did discuss some things, some takeaways that we did put in your packets, and I am going to let Councilmember Todd go over more about the ideas we had about the CARES Act. But I wanted to make sure that there were a few takeaways that I had from the meeting that I wanted to make sure I laid out as well. One of those was we had a great class called Council Members and Mayors. You can't live with them. You can't live without them. And I really enjoyed that class. And I had some nice broad takeaways where it discusses for us the roles of council, the roles of mayors, the roles of the city managers in our form of government. And there's some nice examples in there, some times when the councils and mayors have sued each other, all kinds of excitement. And my takeaway from that was that not only can I benefit from having a training, I feel like, for our roles so that I understand my role better and everybody else's roles. But I thought that the rest of council may appreciate and be able to benefit from some form of training on this where we go over in a little more detail what our roles are and where we're not supposed to step over. I think that would be very helpful. And I also thought it would be helpful for the public even to understand what each individual's roles are, so they know when they're talking to us what we can and can't do as well. And another thing that came up in one of the sessions, I think it was the advocacy session, was a discussion that it's very important with COVID-19 especially, that we make sure that we're on, we have an understanding as an entire council of what our needs are gonna be from our legislature. So if they, which they probably will, have an emergency session, and then when they go into session next year, that we are prepared and ready to lobby them for what we need as a city. And I think we need to make sure we're on board with that sooner rather than later, because we want to make sure that each one of us individually is going to our representatives with a unified message of what our residents need and what the city of Mill Creek needs, and so that we're heard and hopefully get what we need. So that was my main takeaways from that, other than the CARES Act discussion that I'm going to leave to Council Member Todd when it's his turn. Thank you.
And Stephanie, thanks for bringing that up. Michael and I have been trying to get a training scheduled. We just haven't got it done so far with everything going on. I think that would be incredibly valuable. We just haven't, with this electronic meeting, just haven't been able to get stuff scheduled. So, but we will. Good idea. Okay, are you done? Brian, do you have a report?
Yeah, just two items. One's a request and one's an update. The request is request for Michael and Matt. I don't need an answer tonight, but they've been putting in the new ramps along Seattle Hill Road in anticipation of the overlay. It's just caught my attention because, as you know, the public probably knows, when we overlay these roads,
we have to go to pretty significant cost to update the ADA ramps. And what surprised me was when we did 148th outside of my neighborhood 4 or 5 years ago, the latest and greatest technology had the ramps kind of channelized with a vertical curb channel coming down for the wheelchairs. So it caught my eye when I've been riding along in the mornings on Seattle Hill Road and seeing these very, what appear to me to be basic ramps. And I'm looking at these things, scratching my head, is what is different in the engineering that makes this more accessible than prior iterations of the ramp? I mean, I'm all for accessibility, but I'm looking at these ramps trying to figure out what is it from an engineering perspective that makes them so much better than what the prior iteration was that required us to upgrade them. So I'd just be interested in hearing the latest and greatest on ADA technology because we go to this cost every time we overlay a road, and it's not an insignificant cost. The update is, and I apologize for not giving this at the last meeting, the mayor, myself, Michael, Grace, have been working with an outside consultant, Karen Reed, on putting together a process for doing Michael's review for this year, but also a process we could use going forward. Karen Reed is a consultant. She was the facilitator on the HART committee process that we went through last year with the county executive. And she has also worked for the last few years with the city of Bothell on their review process. So tomorrow we hope to be circulating a conceptual process for you to digest in the next 7 days, and we'll have it as an agenda item for us to discuss next week so that we could hopefully come to some consensus and get rolling with Michael's annual review. We will say I want to discuss next week the possibility of possibly having a few special meetings in August to deal with the evaluation so we can get it wrapped up sooner rather than later. We're getting a little bit of a late start on it, but I think it's important that we try to wrap this up and not let it drag in too far into the fall. And so part of the discussion I'd like to have next week is people's availability if we need to meet once or twice in August for special executive council executive committee meetings to discuss the process. So that will be, Michael, if you could have Grace circulate that latest iteration that I think we finalized today and for the council to review tomorrow.
We will.
That's all I had.
Okay, Mike, launch.
Well, gosh, I was hoping somebody else was going to cover this, but I guess I got to do it. But before I get into the AWC thing, I want to pile on with Brian's comment about the ADA ramps. You know, not too long ago, we were talking about ADA ramps with respect to the RRFBs, and the comment was, oh, if we do them, they're not going to change. But I'm flabbergasted why we took out about 5 ADA ramps that look perfectly good to me and are replacing them now in the Seattle Hill Road project. Good news is most of the money came from the feds, but I'm scratching my head along with Councilmember or Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw on why do we have to keep changing these things? I get it that we've got to do it for the feds, but boy, I'm frustrated by why we put them in and take them out. And the current ones, I should send a picture. I will send a picture to Matthew. There's one of them that's got the flow line for the gutter that's going to make that so it builds up dirt on top of the truncated domes. I don't understand why that's happening either, but I'll take up that engineering issue with Matthew later on. Back to the AWC report. So I would encourage people to take a look at that. I know you hate to read this stuff, but read the couple of page report we put together, the three of us did. And I think it's good. We're going to have a discussion next week about the CARES Act funding. The reality is, to put this in perspective, we have on the order of $600,000+ that are available to Mill Creek based on our population for responses to COVID from the federal CARES Act money. And throughout the conference, it was interesting to hear what other cities were doing with that money. For instance, Arlington, about our same size, about the same amount of money, made a projection that they were going to use maybe half of it for their own needs for emergency preparations and response, and decided to take a couple hundred thousand and put it out to small business grants and 100,000 towards individuals in their community who'd lost their jobs and needed help paying utilities or rent or things like that. I got the sense after coming to the conference and talking to other folks that our job was to pass that along. indeed, we need to be somewhat selfish and pay ourselves first for the direct costs we've got. But if Jeff can help us next week talk about what we might project as the worst case of what we're going to use and what might be left over, as much as I hate my federal taxes being what they are, I think the reality is they're going to print the money. We shouldn't let it go back to Washington, D.C. Let's make sure it's used in our community as appropriate. So I encourage us to think about creatively what we can do to make that happen. And the clock is ticking. We have to spend the money, get invoiced by the end of October, and I guess submit the invoice by middle of November so that the state can comply with the federal mandate for the end of the year. So we don't want to come up with a great idea and then have it run out of funds, because then that comes out of our pocket. So I encourage people to take a look at that. Stephanie did a good job of hitting a couple of the sessions that I really love too. The good news is we went into this, oh, it's limited attendance, but it was free. It turned out that it's now free to everybody. And so those sessions that were recorded are out there and available. So while we may want to do a special training like Stephanie proposed on the role of council and mayor and the city manager, it would be okay if people went and looked at that video themselves as a preparatory background for us to have a discussion. Or if you see some of those other sessions that are interesting, as you mentioned, go and do that. It's available to everybody. I think everybody got the AWC link that said those are now available through the end of the year, end of the calendar year. And I concur with her, the legislative agenda, it's important that we, through the fall, not at the end of the fall, but early in the fall, develop a city legislative agenda and figure out what we want to do to ask our legislators, whether it be the ones we have today or that we have some new ones, which we will, that we work with them on developing that legislative agenda, make sure Mill Creek is not forgotten. And the last thing, I'm going to throw it back to the mayor. She and I talked about this. I'm going to remind you, Pam, the 1406 housing money, we were going to figure we need to do something by the end of July. Otherwise, that money that we authorized that kind of comes to us for free, we're going to talk about putting it at some other agency. And I'm not sure if Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw from the Heart Group or Mayor yourself, you know what we want to do, but we should tee that up so we don't miss the deadline for making that happen. So I'm going to turn it back over to you for that. Thanks.
No problem. Jeff, can you fill them in? Because I was not aware, but we've already done our stuff. So Jeff, can you give us an update on that?
Absolutely. And yes, Mayor, thank you. And a great question, Councilmember Todd. I worked a lot with Tom Rogers on this point. So Tom, feel free to jump in on it. Tom identified that we actually, the city was very proactive last year prior to year end. So we have already approved the resolution last year and adopted the ordinance. And that ordinance is what we needed mandatorily by July 28th to have accomplished. And we have done that. What the other optional piece is identifying a qualifying local tax. So if you wanted to double your tax, which is not something that the city decided to do. So that's the optional piece that is due at the end of July. But we have sent in to the Department of Revenue the resolution and the ordinance, and we have already received the credit, and we're moving forward from the Department of Revenue. So I think we're in good order.
So all we have left is to pick an agency that we're going, or what we're going to do with the money.
That is correct, and that is not date specific.
Okay. Yep, Mike?
Well, that's excellent news. So we don't have no hurry to do anything more. I'm great. Thanks for reminding us that. But we're going to have $25,000-ish every year coming in. We got to figure out something to do with that. And we talked about partnering with somebody else. But you're saying we could just let that build up in an account, and we could figure that out 3 or 6 months from now, we're okay.
Yes, council member.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Vince.
Yeah, Mayor, thank you. Real quick, I want to thank Councilmember Todd for bringing that up about the additional 600K stimulus money. And if we want to put some sort of group together to see how the nuts and bolts of that work out, I would love to make sure that is delivered to the members of our community, because I have a ton of small businesses that would be incredibly thankful for the opportunity.
Okay, well, we have a full presentation scheduled for next week, so that's a big item on our agenda.
Sorry.
Ben?
And I won't be here next week. I'll be hiking in Utah. So that's why I threw that out there.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, Mike, do you have anything else for your reports? Okay, Michael, we're up to you.
Thank you, Mayor. I have two items. First of all, I received notice from Phillips Publishing Company, Peter Phillips, that the publisher of our City Connection magazine, that the company is closing its doors. In that regard, we are working on a continuity plan, but also we'll be coming to council to say, is this something we want to do? I've spoken with Sue Rembeck from Mill Creek Living magazine, and we are in the process of putting together the numbers and coming back to city council to do a check-in to make sure we're all on the same page, whether we want to continue with a quarterly publication, perhaps a biennium publication, or just continue it all together. So that's just a heads up about a future discussion item. Also, with regard to the proclamation, I know we were all hoping to go into phase three. That, of course, has not happened. I would ask for the council to move to extend the proclamation of emergency through our last meeting in July to July 28th. I would ask for council's support in that regard.
I thought we extended it so it lasts as long as the proclamation is in effect.
No, we didn't.
That was the idea, but Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw, the consent, or the, as my notes reflect, it was it ended July 1, actually.
Yep.
I'm mistaken. I'm happy to be correct.
Yep, you're correct.
I might be something else. I'm all for extending it.
So is that your motion to extend it through to July 28th? Or why July 28th? I mean, are you going to remember?
Mayor, that's the next council meeting.
Okay.
The last council meeting in July. Hopefully we'll have the health data and direction from governor, you know, that we can have a more informed decision. I don't want to go out too far because I'm trying to preserve.
So we need a motion to... What is it that you're wanting?
Motion to extend the proclamation of emergency to July 28th, 2020.
Does it make sense to go to the end of August since we're not going to be meeting in August? Or should I say September, first Tuesday in September?
Does it have to
Michael?
Be in 30 minutes?
Michael? Councilman Bond, that I was preserving hope had to do with Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw's suggestion about my evaluation in August. We may have a special meeting that would hopefully facilitate, we could facilitate right here at City Council Chambers rather than in the go-to format. If the council, it's their pleasure to move it to the first meeting in September, I can go along with that.
Brian, does that work with you?
Yes.
Okay, so you want a motion to extend the emergency proclamation to
second.
September 1st. Michael, is that what you want?
Yep, Mayor, just stand by. I'm looking at the council calendar and just want to make certain that maybe we move it to the actual date. I'm not comfortable with the gaps that we have.
September 1 is the next date.
Sorry, my computer here is freezing up.
September 1 is the first Tuesday in September.
Yes, September 1st. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay, so we need a motion to extend the emergency proclamation to September 1st, 2020.
We'll move.
We have a motion?
Second.
Need a second? So we have a motion by Councilmember Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw, a second by Councilmember Bond to extend to September 1st. Any further discussion? All those in
I understand. Thank you, Mayor. When we gave these powers emergency declaration, the whole goal was to address the emergency at hand. It was when we didn't know a lot of things, and there were many things up in the air. And this has nothing to do with the city manager and how he's conducted himself. I think it's been great. I'm not going to support extending the emergency declaration. I think there have been, and many people agree, that across this country, abuses of the emergency declaration and extensions. I really do appreciate this body continuing to come back every 30 days to do it as it's supposed to do. Many people have gotten off the rails on that. I would prefer that the emergency declaration end at this point. I don't think we're in that same circumstances when we contrived it, so I won't be supporting it.
Okay, any further discussion? John? Councilmember Steckler?
Yeah, I just wanted to point a clarification. So this is separate from the issues of whether or not we open up City Hall or not, correct?
Michael?
Mm-hmm. No, they're not separate and apart. I'm reading from the actual proclamation language that in recommendations for social distancing issued by Centers for Disease Control, Snohomish Health District, the City of Mill Creek will restrict access to City Hall and to the general public in an effort to slow the spread of the COVID-19 virus. We're working very hard to max out at 5 staff members that are present here at any given time, and the rest telecommute. So to your question, Councilman Steckler, I see this as part and parcel of the proclamation and the social distancing guidelines to maximize our health.
So what we're saying here is that we are going to be extending the closure of City Hall up until early September by agreeing to this.
No.
And Vince said no. I thought that's what our city manager said.
We're giving the city manager the authorization to do that, you know, at his purview.
Michael?
Yes, if I were to modify this, I would be coming to council at the next available meeting for any reason. If we have really good numbers and we're able to go into phase 3, that would be such an example of what may be worthy for us to, if necessary, call a special meeting. But I think we're all seeing the same data, and I'm trying to strike that balance, understandably, between the access the community deserves to their public facilities, and the need for us to follow the governor's guidelines as well as our local Department of Health data.
So what we're saying is that Michael would have to come back to us to come out of a state of emergency in order to open up City Hall.
No. No.
Michael?
Grant, if you can give additional insight on this, I know that I have the discretion to do it on an interim basis, but I like to keep myself on as short a leash as possible when I do these things to make sure that I've got council support for what I do.
I believe under your emergency declaration, you could terminate the current ban on meetings in City Hall at your discretion. Should you have appropriate guidance from both the governor's proclamations and any other appropriate authorities?
Okay, Mike Todd?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, John, finish.
Oh, if we extend this out, it is Michael can cancel it and open up City Hall, or not cancel it and not open up City Hall at his discretion up until September, correct? So we could come into phase 3, and it would be up to Michael to evaluate whether or not he thinks it makes good sense for us to open up or not open up. And I just want to clarify that by extending this, I kind of go back to, you know, I see the point the Councilmember Bond made. I like it, does make sense, but it might be better to go back to what the city manager originally suggested, that maybe it's best to just extend it, you know, till July 28th, and then we can reevaluate at that point. At that point, we may want to extend it to September, but we're gonna, it's surprising how much things can change in a matter of a couple of weeks. They can get worse. They could get better. You just don't know. That's my thought. Sir, go ahead, Councilmember Todd.
And then Councilmember Cavallari.
Yeah, thanks. I was just going to say that I think that under this, we don't have the declaration in front of us, and the city manager's got us, we got it in front of him, probably we could have him read it. But I think what we're doing is we're saying, let's not have council only meeting three times a month be critical path on making decisions that are outside of our control right now. But for instance, if somehow miraculously the county went to phase three on July 17th, and we didn't meet for another week and a half, it would be good for the city manager to have the ability to say, you know, we're going to open passport office under these, under my guidance, I'm going to go for it. That's why we're giving him some emergency powers. Councilmember Steckler has made a good point. We could revisit this on the 28th and extend it again. But I think this goes both ways. Number one, we're giving the city manager some power to make decisions, but we're also giving him ability to make good decisions, to move things faster in his judgment instead of waiting for us, because we council don't want to be the limiting factor. And I think we're looking ahead to August. We don't want to go a whole month without having him have the authority to open passports on August 2nd, or August 10th, or August 20th. Thanks.
Okay, Vincent.
Thank you, Mayor. So, as Michael just put it, he would be willing to kind of roll along with what the governor is saying, and that's how he's going to operate. So that is not an emergency declaration I want to give my city manager. If we are going to have this discussion now, and I'm happy to do so, while cases may be increasing, the death for the seventh week in a row, the death rate has decreased. For the 11th week in a row, the hospitalization rate has decreased for people positive with COVID. So I don't want to wait on Governor Inslee to decide our fate in this city. People don't want to wait for Governor Inslee to decide our fate. So this is why I don't support. This is why the moment is fluid, and each city should have the autonomy to understand its own situation and give governance to its own people. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? So right now we have a motion to extend the emergency proclamation to September 1st, 2020. No further discussion? Any further discussion? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Abstentions? So it passes 6-1 with Councilmember Cavallari in opposition. Okay, Michael, anything else?
No, Mayor, that concludes my report. Thank you.
Okay. Jeff, did you have anything for us?
Yes, I did, Mayor.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Council. I just wanted to give the Council and the public an update on the projections, just to kind of regroup and talk a little bit about what I've covered. If you recall, the last time we had a presentation, we're looking about 2.5 years out, going through the next biennium, and identifying roughly about a $4.2 million potential shortfall in revenue that we would have anticipated pre-COVID-19. We also took a look at a number of different projection models from smaller entities to larger entities, such as the state. And we've identified that we are considered conservative in that spectrum, but we are consistent with those models, and we are, as the state is, we're looking long-term over multi-year recovery process. But during that projection and in that model, if you recall, we only had 1 week of actual data for sales and use tax. And although if you extrapolate that out, it only indicated that we're off by maybe 3 points, so insignificant, we really wanted to wait until we receive April's full month. And we are still waiting on the property tax information that should be coming in about the 10th or 11th of this month. But we did receive the sales and use tax for April, and it showed a $78,000 increase versus the same month last year. That's actually a 31.7% increase year over year for the month. And so kind of looking into that, there's a number of different factors that can influence that. We do know that there was a heavy trend on groceries kind of stocking up. We saw that, for example, if it was toilet paper, meat supplies, and that sort of thing. So we saw that, as well as we saw retailers such as Lowe's with significant increases as people are staying at home and working on projects. We also have, as the council knows, several different projects, construction projects going on, including the farm. And we did reach out to the farm. The planning group was fantastic in helping us make those connections. And we've identified that they're projecting about $41 million worth of construction sales over the next 12 months. The problem is, and we're working on trying to get the layout of that cash flow of when it, because that'll have an impact of, you know, when the we'll see that sales and use tax come in. We do not have that yet, but if you convert that over into the sales tax, that's roughly $193,000 over a 12-month time frame. So that was not in the projection that we had before. So that's a good upside there. We are working with the Department of Revenue to get the confidential visibility, so our projection models can be a lot more accurate and we can dial that in. So we're actively working on that, as well as, like I said, working with the other construction firms to figure out when their cash flow is expected to come in. As well, motor fuel tax came in, and that did come in $18,000 below last year, or roughly negative 45.4%. That's right on target of what we actually anticipated in our projection model. As well, REIT came in right where we expected it to be based on our projection model. Again, dramatically down for obvious reasons. I do want to emphasize this. Ultimately, short term, we are looking pretty good. But if you strip away the one-time expenses, long term, we still have a significant issue. And in fact, when you lay in the farm and pull that out of that, if you remember the $4.2 million over 2.5 years, you're right around the $4 million mark still. So what's key is that we continue to get more data. We continue to look at the detail, and we continue to collect the actuals coming through. We are pressing hard on Department of Revenue trying to get that that confidential visibility, and that way we can help the council guide what the projection is looking at with a little more certainty. And again, I just want to emphasize the variance is great right now with limited data sets. And then just a quick update on COVID-19 related actual expenses to date. We're at $58,000, and that includes PPE and also some construction material that we have going on within City Hall, trying to make it safer for the public and staff. And that's my update, Mayor.
Thank you. John?
Thank you, Mayor. I do apologize. I had a couple of suggestions on the AWC that I wanted to make at the end of Michael's, and we got going. I just wanted to make two suggestions that were already brought up. One, Councilmember Vignal mentioned the council roles, you know, love them and leave them, all that. It actually was very informative. We talked about the training. The recommendation I was going to make was on our website, I think it'd be a great idea if the marketing department were to put a short clarification on the type of government that we have here in Mill Creek between the council members and the city manager and the roles of each. I think a lot of people don't understand it, and it would help them when they have an issue and a concern. Who do I talk to? Who should I be directing it to? As you know, we get a lot of things directed to us as council members that really should go to the city manager, but they need to understand that. So I was going to make that recommendation that I think it would help to clarify the type of government that we are. The other one is, as Councilmember Vignal also mentioned, I really enjoyed the extended, the legislative session piece. And we have, I believe, next year is the extended session, the longer session. And coming at the heels of our budget planning, I was going to suggest that as we're putting together our biannual budget, and maybe we've always done this, and I just didn't know it because I haven't been around that long, but it might be a great idea to set aside a team of two or three of us that we isolate the targets of what we want to get from our state government in support, and those three people that can go to the legislature in unison, in power, to request support from our legislative officials. I think it'd be a little bit more powerful if it was three of us rather than just one of us, or even the individual capacity a few of us trying to, you know, do our own end arounds. I think it would be good to be unified in our efforts and appeal to our state government. That was my two suggestions, and they're only suggestions. Thank you.
Okay, Mike Todd? Yeah, Mike? Oh, you said a thumbs up. Sorry, I thought you wanted to say something. Sorry, I look for any signal that one of you wants to talk. Okay, yeah, Vince, I've seen your signals. Okay, so that's the end of that. So we're back to audience communication. Before we adjourn, does anybody have anything to say to the council?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead. Name, address, and 3 minutes.
Barb Heidel, 1401 144th Place, Southeast Mill Creek. I want to express my appreciation for continuing these virtual meetings. I do not feel comfortable attending a meeting in council chambers yet, and I do want to, as you know, attend these meetings. If in the near future the meetings are held in the chambers, in the near future, I do wish those who want can still call in or do the online attendance until we all feel comfortable, especially as senior citizens. Thank you.
Thanks, Barb. And we are, I've talked to the city manager and Jeff about that to see how we can possibly do that. Okay, anybody else?
Yes, I'd like to speak. Ladies first.
Okay, Kim? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Name, address, and 3 minutes.
Kim Mason Hatt. I do not live in the city of Mill Creek. Long-term employee. I just want to let you know, as a public person participating in these meetings, it would be nice to be able to, somebody needs to mute, sorry. It would be nice to be able to access the Zoom or GoTo meeting so that the people that are home watching this can also see what the council members are seeing in the way of slideshows during the meeting and not have to wait until after the meeting. So that's just my suggestion on that. And I'd also like to talk about some of the laid off employees. Maybe you know, maybe you don't know, but tonight is the last meeting that Tom Rogers is going to be participating in. Excuse me.
Oh, God.
He's provided almost 30 years of service to the city. Almost all of what you see in the city and how it looks, he has had a hand in. I'd like to thank him for his dedication to the city. It's unfortunate that this is how the city is choosing to end his employment, by sending him an impersonal email in the dark of night without a thank you for your service and hard work. It's terribly disappointing that no one here, nobody present tonight, has even acknowledged his pending departure or his contribution to this city. So I will. Thank you, Tom Rogers. Your hard work has been appreciated, and you will be missed. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else want to talk to the council? I heard another voice.
Yes, please.
Okay, name, address, and 3 minutes.
Okay, John Raymer, 831 148th Street Southeast in Mill Creek. I was very glad to hear about the new finance numbers from Jeff. Thank you very much. It was also good to hear from the union. And I hope that the council is listening to the numbers that came in that shows that perhaps the financial crisis is not as much of a crisis as it has been led to. And that perhaps the options being offered by the union are going to be considered by the council before any more decisions are made. And while we're talking about money and cuts, we still haven't heard anything about the hiring of permanent staff members instead of the interim personal appointments. Both of our personal interim appointments happen to live outside of the Mill Creek area, indeed outside of Washington. When I spoke to the interim chief of staff on the phone, I asked her what she was doing. She said she was at home in Ohio. I'd like the council to confirm what the real home of record for our interim employees is And are we actually sending nearly $200,000 a year of pay outside of the state of Washington? Now, with these new finance numbers, perhaps cutting four of our employees is not necessarily needed, has been led to believe in the past. Maybe it's a time to reconsider that. I'd hope that every week we can get a new update on our finances from Jeff. That was a great report. It's very important to hear, especially knowing what our money is going to be spent on. I would also like to ask, if entirely possible, would like to see what that expense list of legal expenses, that $700,000 over budget, I'd like to hear that before we go on break. And if not, then definitely the first thing after break. Things are going good in the city. From outside the city, I happen to agree with the Councilman Vince that I think the emergency declaration probably isn't as needed as has been led to believe, because there's a lot more information known today than what we knew 2 or 3 months ago. So I think the city council needs to pay attention to what's going on and make some good decisions for yourselves and for the rest of the citizens of our city. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Anybody else want to talk to the council tonight?
Yes, Daniel Carr.
Oh, go ahead, Daniel. Name, address, and 3 minutes.
For sure. Daniel Carr, 7C Swim School. That was the study session. I actually live just outside in Bothell, but that's the property that we have purchased. I'd just like to call the attention to the council and the mayor. First of all, appreciate your time and energy in doing that. Into October 8th, 2019's city council meeting, study session number E, which is the 2020-2025 traffic improvement plan, action item number 20. It talks about the North Creek Drive sidewalk. It is on that budget for 2023-2024 to put sidewalks in that entire North Creek Drive, which leads up to our property line. So I'd ask the council to consider that when they are looking at the right of way, because that is included in that. So I ask that they consider the 661 square feet that was previously mentioned by the city council as part of the calculations in that.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to talk to the council? Okay, Michael?
Hi.
Michael?
Yes, Mayor.
I oopsed it and we're 8 minutes past 8:30. Can we have Mike, I was looking at you. So do we need to extend the meeting 8 minutes or do we just adjourn?
We should motion to extend 8 minutes and then adjourn. I don't want to.
Please don't. Give us 9 minutes, please.
Okay, we need a motion to extend 9 minutes. We need a motion.
Motion to extend. 9 minutes.
We have a motion and a second. Cavallari and Vignelle. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. So we're extended nine. We have 1 minute, Mark. Did you want to say something?
Yes. So I'm appropriately embarrassed, and I'm very grateful for Kim to bring to our attention that tonight is Tom Rogers' last night. Tom, thank you for your service. Kim was absolutely right. I appreciate the work you've done. Your fingerprints are all over this city. My apologies for not recognizing you and your service. I was wrong. I'm embarrassed, as I should be, but I'm grateful for your service. Thank you, Tom. And thank you for bringing to our attention.
Okay, and with that, it is now 8:39. We are adjourned. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Pathetic.